Welcome to the Every Nation New York podcast. Every Nation exists to help people know God, grow together, discover purpose, and make a difference in New York City and beyond. Enjoy the talk.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. Yeah, I've been connected with your church since it actually began. And I remember even at Kings Park when we saw the 9/11 tragedy. And what happened is, like, the next day, Pastor Ron Lewis drove up to New York with another pastor, and this church was birthed, like, the day after 9/11. It was really extraordinary. But it's also very special because a lot of my faith journey is very much tied to this community of faith, particularly back in North Carolina. Because when I was growing up, I was raised in the church, but for me, it was more of a cultural experience. But I read through the Bible, and then it became more alive. But I went to MIT, and I wasn't prepared for the attacks against my faith that I received. I went to a class on the Bible, and the professor was an agnostic and basically said the Bible is a bunch of nonsense. It's just historically a fiction. There are certain political agendas. I became convinced that Christianity probably wasn't true. And then I read a man named Richard Dawkins. Who's heard of Richard Dawkins? Yeah, here's a picture of Richard Dawkins, and he's one of the patron saints of atheism, and he wrote a book called The God Delusion, and I don't think I have to say any more about the book than that, and he argued that when you look at nature, you may think you see design, but it's all an illusion. Everything is simply a product of the blind forces of nature, and I became pretty convinced that Christianity was just a psychological crutch. God probably didn't exist. It seemed like people of faith were just people that just did it blindly, that they didn't ask hard questions, that they just kind of suppressed all those doubts that they had. Well, people of science, they were the intellectuals who went after the truth and wanted to know what the world was really like. And that was really disheartening because I was being trained as a physicist. And I remember going to my room and saying, God, I don't really know if you exist, but if you do exist, you have to prove it to me. Because I'm a scientist, I just can't do this blindly. You have to. Maybe that's against the rules, maybe that's not fair, but that's just the way it has to be. And then I went on a very long journey where I studied science and history and comparative religions and archaeology and all sorts of different disciplines. And over that journey, what I realized is that the evidence for the Christian faith is pretty overwhelming, that the evidence for the resurrection is so extraordinary that it'd be hard to find any other event in all of history of that scope that is better supported than the resurrection. And when you look at science, what you find is the evidence of a designer in science is pretty overwhelming. In fact, what people often say is a little science will take you away from God, but a lot of science will bring you back. And that's the situation. And that's what I'm going to share for you today. And what I want to first deal with is the why is it relevant? Because if we're simply a product of the blind forces of nature, life has no purpose. It doesn't matter if I'm kind or cruel, if I help the poor, or if I oppress the poor. I will die, my memories will be lost, they will die, their memories is lost. Eventually the sun will explode and vaporize the planet, and even if we could colonize outer space, like in the movie Interstellar, which is really unlikely actually, eventually the universe will run out of free energy and it'll just be particles floating through space. No point. I mean, those are very grim thoughts I had as a freshman, but that's where I was. And what happened, though, is really seeking after God for the truth. That put me on a long spiritual journey. And it really is amazing how God met me both intellectually and supernaturally. So I'm going to talk a bit about that evidence. And I want to just start by a quote by a man named Richard Lawrence Krauss. And what Lawrence Krauss said was that we constitute a 1% of pollution in the universe. We are completely irrelevant. So my angst was not just me, it's just reality. That people who don't believe in a creator are living a life of self-deception and self-denial. And that's why people are so addicted to entertainment or to sports or fantasy football or whatever, because they have to numb that angst in their soul knowing that their life is pointless. But the exciting thing is it's not pointless because there is a designer, and I'll talk about why. Now, let's first deal with the myth that faith and science are in conflict. Who's heard that before? I mean, who's heard that from your office people or your professors? And the idea is this narrative that you have the scientists who are trying to present truth to people, and the religious bigots are trying to hold people back from the truth. So science and faith are in opposition, but it's actually the opposite. Because if you look at the early scientists, most of them are Christian, like Newton, Boyle, and Kepler, and Galileo. And it was their faith that compelled them to do science. Because if you think we're simply here by the blind forces of nature, that all we are is simply a mixture of chemicals, why would our brain evolve in such a way to be able to understand quantum mechanics, or general, or at least my brain as a physicist? Why would that be the case? That makes no sense. But if we're created by God, what happens is that there's a God who's a lawgiver, and the same God that gave moral laws gave physical laws to make our universe run properly. And because we're created in God's image, we're created with the ability to understand the order in the world. And Genesis talks about going out and basically taking stewardship of the earth and making something of it. So it's a commission to do science. Now, what's really extraordinary also is even people who are not particularly religious, like Albert Einstein, recognize this. Like Albert Einstein has this beautiful quote where he says, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible." Because we live in what many people would call sort of the secular age, if you know about Taylor's writings. And there's sort of this ethos that we experience that there is no transcendent reality, but within us, God put eternity in our hearts and it's breaking out. But people keep trying to suppress it. And what's happening is as the science advances, the ability to suppress the evidence around us becomes more and more difficult because the evidence becomes clear. And one of the amazing places of that is science. Because who's familiar with the Big Bang Theory? Now, I'm not talking about the TV show with Penny and Sheldon. I'm talking about the scientific theory that you have the universe started at a point. And because of general relativity, because of the Friedman equations and all that sort of stuff, and the observation of the expansion of the universe, we know that all of time, matter, energy, and space started at a point in the past. Why is that significant? Because nothing starts itself out of nothing. Like, you don't see Coke cans appear out of nowhere. So whatever created the universe is outside of time and space and infinitely powerful and personal, because only a personal being can choose to create. So what you see is that there's this all-powerful being outside of time and space that created everything in a burst of energy, a burst of light. Why does that sound familiar? I've heard that before. Oh, it sounds like Genesis 1. In the beginning, God said, "Let there be light." God created the heavens and the earth. So that's really extraordinary. In fact, many atheists resisted the evidence of a begining because they knew the theistic implications. Like Fred Hoyle was a physicist that came up with the term Big Bang as mockery and ridicule because he didn't like the implications. But the evidence is even more amazing because when you study physics and you study chemistry and you study cosmology and earth planetary science, what you realize is that the universe was designed for life. If the laws of physics were slightly different, if gravity were slightly heavier or slightly less intense, if the force that pulled the proton and the electron together were slightly stronger or slightly weaker, we wouldn't have life. In fact, a great analogy is, have you ever seen like a mixer board? In fact, we may have a mixer board in this room someplace. And basically, this mixer board has lots of knobs and dials, which controls things like the bass and other things I don't know because I don't know anything about music. I could fake it, but I'm a physicist, you'd probably believe me. But at any rate, the crimson knob you have to turn. At any rate, and the idea is, if you imagine that this mixer board is a universe starter kit. So this mixer board you get for Christmas, and it starts universes. That's pretty awesome. And you start to turn the knobs and dials, and you create a universe. You turn the dials and knobs, you create another universe. Well, the reality is, for a universe to support life, these dials have to be perfectly set, dozens of them. So, for instance, I mentioned a man named Fred Hoyle. And again, Fred Hoyle studied the way atoms were formed in stars. It's called nucleosynthesis. And he realized that the reason there's life in our universe is because there's a lot of carbon and oxygen, lots of it, which is highly unexpected, at least if you're an astrophysicist. And what he realized is, for there to be that much carbon in the universe, there had to be this very special energy level in carbon that allowed beryllium and helium to come together in just the right way to present lots of carbon. If that energy was slightly different, there wouldn't be carbon, no life. And to have oxygen, you have to have these special energy levels in oxygen that are at just the right point. And beryllium has to have a long half-life. So there's all these cosmic coincidences that have to be right that are highly improbable for us to have a universe with carbon and oxygen and therefore life. In fact, Fred Hoyle made this amazing quote. He says, a common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. He's an atheist. What happened, though, is a study of science crushed his atheist unbelief because of appearance or design. In fact, some of the knobs are truly amazing, because if you think about how finely do you have to tune that knob to get the right amount of gravity? You ever like drive in the mountains and it's really hard to get that radio station? So you have to get the right tuning, you have to kick it a little bit and then you get the radio to come in. Well, here's the precision you need. Anyone ever shoot rifles or go marksmanship? You look like you would be a tougher guy. So what's the furthest distance someone could shoot a 1-inch target? I mean, if you're Jason Bourne, maybe 2 miles. I think that's about it, right? But the precision needed to set gravity would be like you're shooting a target the size of an amoeba at the other end of our galaxy. That's the precision necessary to set gravity for us to have life. Points to a designer. And it's even beyond that, because it's not just that the laws of physics have to be right, but think about all that has to be right with our planet, with our moon, with our sun. So this is a nice picture of the planet of Earth with the sun. And to get life on Earth, you've got to have a planet that's the right distance from the sun, the right tilt, the right rotation rate. You have to have a magnetic shield that protects us from radiation. You have to have plate tectonics that recycle materials. You've got to have a moon the right size and distance to stabilize our orbit, or else the weather patterns would go crazy and we have 1,000-mile-per-hour winds everywhere, not to mention the moon circulates the ocean. You got to have a sun that produces the right amount of energy, that's stable, that's the right age. You got to have an atmosphere that lets the right energy in. You have to be in the right place in the galaxy, etc., etc., etc. There's hundreds of these parameters. And there's really no chance, realistically, that you'd have a planet in the universe that could support life without a designer. But it gets even better. Gets even better. Because it's not just that the laws of physics and the details of our planet, our moon, our sun, our star, our galaxy were set for life, but the same parameters that allow for life allow for scientific investigation. So not only does our atmosphere allow us to breathe, but it's actually transparent so that we can see the stars. Not all atmospheres are transparent, so we can do astronomy. The magnetic shield that protects us from the sun also allows us to navigate the oceans. Plate tectonics, which recycles the materials, takes creatures that have been dead for a long time and puts them on the top of mountains so that we can see the past in God's glory and of his creation without having to live with dinosaurs, which would be bad if you've seen Jurassic Park. But one of my favorites is to have technology, you need fire, because fire is what will melt metals, which will create tools. But if you look at fire, what happens is to get fire that works properly on the planet, you have to have the right amount of oxygen. Because if you have too much, you burn down all your forests, kind of like in California. If you have too little, you can't produce fire, no technology. So again, the list goes on and on. And why is this so significant? Well, let me use an analogy just to kind of give you an idea of why this is important. You go hiking. I mean, just imagine you go hiking in the woods and you come across a cabin in the woods. Not that nasty movie, but the cabin in the woods. And you find in the cabin, there's your favorite food in the refrigerator, there's your favorite clothes in the closet, which is interesting, but then you walk in the living room and there's your pictures of your relatives on the wall. And that's getting a little bit creepy. And now you notice there's a cell phone with your best friend's numbers programmed into it. Now, I'm guessing if you encounter that, you wouldn't say to yourself, what an amazing coincidence. Wow. You'd recognize that somebody knew you were coming and designed everything with you in mind. And that's exactly what you see with our universe, our planet, and every detail of our local stellar system. So when you look at physics, it screams out design intended for us. Because we're the only people that can study the stars. I've never seen a chimpanzee with a telescope or produce fire. Now, one of the areas of science that people feel is most in conflict with faith is that of biology. They think, well, you know, evolution has proven that we're simply a product of the blind forces of nature. Well, I've been able to work with some of the top scientists in the world who've studied some of these issues. I was at the Royal Society of London. That is one of the most prestigious scientific institutions. And what you're seeing as those arguments are collapsing as the science advances. Now let's begin with the origin of life. Because before you can get evolution, you've got to have a cell. I mean, it helps to have a cell that self-replicates before it can evolve. And the reality is, it's actually a physical impossibility for life to form without design. Now again, my specialty was complex systems physics. So these are sorts of the questions that we wrestle with, is how do you get a lot of intricate interacting pieces to form something complex and create emergent properties? Well, what do you find with the origin of life is that the first cell had to be remarkably complex. It had to process energy, it had to self-replicate, it had to manage information, it had to sense the environment and respond to it. And what happens is there is, I mentioned Fred Hoyle again, we might as well keep going, you know, it comes in threes if you know comedy. So Fred Hoyle, what he said is the probability of a bunch of random chemicals forming a cell, is something around the level of 1 in 10 to the power of 40,000. That's 1 divided by a 1 with 40,000 zeros behind it. Now, for those of you that aren't into big numbers, they can be kind of scary this time of the morning. It's kind of like, use the analogy, that if you imagine a junkyard with lots of pieces of plane parts, it'd be like a tornado coming through the junkyard, throwing all the pieces up in the air, assembling them, and they fall down as a 747 airplane ready to fly. That's the probability. Now, that would seem discouraging, but if I were to present this to, let's say, an origin of life meeting, they say, Dr. Miller, you're so naive. Oh, my goodness. Aren't you aware that no origin of life specialist believes that life came about by chance? It came about through some natural laws. There's these mysterious laws in the universe, and what they do is they cause things to self-organize through complex systems theory, which was my PhD, to form life. Well, there's a little problem with that, and that's going to be expressed with the next slide. So what you find is in nature, there are two dominating tendencies. One is to go from order to disorder, or to go from low entropy to high entropy. Now, that's all kind of technobabble, but let's make it simpler. How many of you find it's easier to keep your room neat or to keep it messy? Yeah, do you find that you want to have a messy room, so you kind of throw everything around, you come back, and it's all neat and tidy again? Not likely unless you live with your mother. So that's the idea that nature wants to go to high entropy or high disorder. Well, the other driving tendency is nature wants to go from low energy to high energy. I mean, it goes from high energy to low energy. Water runs downhill to lower energy. It doesn't run uphill. That never happens unless there's some external help. Well, here's the problem. Life is both high order or low entropy, and life is high energy. So the problem with probability is kind of like if you roll dice. If you roll dice, you'll never get 1,000 sixes in a row unless the dice are loaded. And the biologist always hopes that the dice are loaded in their favor, but because of the energy, the dice are loaded against you. So the chance of rolling even 1 6 is like 1 in a billion. And you have to roll 1,000 of those 1 in a billion sixes. That's the problem with the origin of life. And if you combine the issue of energy or enthalpy and entropy, you get what's called the free energy. And don't worry about that. I'm a physicist, so I couldn't resist mentioning this. But all things in nature go from high free energy to low free energy. There's nothing that does the opposite. And what happened was there is a professor named Dr. Harold Morowitz and said, what's the chance of life forming given these free energy problems? So what happened is he found that the odds dropped, next slide, to 1 in 10 to 100 million. So it went from being impossible to really, really, really impossible. And that's a number I can't even describe. It's so improbable. It's essentially, it's not going to happen. Now, if I presented that to an origin of life talk, they would say, Dr. Miller, you're still being so naive because what you forgot is energy, right? Because you have all this energy from the sun and all this energy is going to cause a cell to self-organize. You hear this all the time. Well, at least if you're in my circles, you do. But the problem is that doesn't make any sense from a very technical perspective. And we'll skip all the cool equations like fluctuation theorems. Again, how tempting that would be, but we'll skip it. Ask me later. But let's use a simple analogy. Let's imagine you come home and your house is an absolute mess. But you just came from an Origin of Life conference and you heard energy can create order, right? Yeah. So you think, that's awesome. So you pour gasoline on your furniture, you set it on fire, And you think the energy from this gasoline burning is going to order my house. Well, you'd more likely get something like that. And it's the exact same thing in life. If you've got, let's say, a half-formed cell, by some miracle, half the stuff is there, any input of energy that's significant will break that cell apart in the same way your fire will burn down your house. It's naive in the extreme. So you think to yourself, okay, well, that didn't work. What will it take for me to order my house? Well, you think, okay, I need a robot, because what does a robot do? It has an engine, right? What do engines do? Engines take in fuel, and they convert that fuel into work that you can use, right? That's an engine. So you can overcome all these problems with an engine. So you have a robot with an engine that either takes fuel, gasoline, or it's a solar power plant, whatever. And you sort of let that robot loose on your house. Is that going to order your house? What happens with robots that you don't program properly? You get this. So just having a robot that processes energy is not helpful. So tell me, what do you need? That means I want you to answer, just so you know, this is an interactive type thing. What do you need besides an engine for the robot to order your house? What do you need? Instructions. Someone say rental truck? Instructions. You need information, right? You need a programmer who programs the information to teach the robot how to properly vacuum your house. So you need machinery to process fuel and information instructions. Well, if we look at a cell, the simplest cells you can imagine, it's the same thing. A cell has a lot of advanced machinery which processes fuel, either sunlight, if it's like a chloroplast or even a simple bacteria, or it processes like sulfur, or it processes glucose or something. So it has engines that process fuel, and then they convert that fuel into work that the cell can use. It turns out it's like ATP or high energy molecules. That's kind of the energy storage centers of the cell. I can tell the two biologists are getting super excited. And you have lots of information in the cell to tell the cell how to use that energy to build itself up. Now, if you think, where is that information hidden? It's in proteins. So one of the main building blocks of a cell is called a protein. And a protein is a long string of amino acids. There's 20 amino acids, almost like the 26 letters in the English alphabet. And when those amino acids have the right sequence, the right information, they fold into the precise three-dimensional shape needed to drive the right reactions and build up the building blocks of the cell. So that information in the amino acids sequences is what tells the cell how to use the information properly. But there's another problem. And here's the issue. Is proteins break down pretty quickly, right? Like, if you never repair your house, what's going to happen to the house? It's going to fall apart, right? Especially if there's like a windstorm or something. So if you want to keep your house, you have to keep repairing it, right? But cell proteins don't self-replicate, so you've got to have machinery inside of the cell to keep replacing the parts. But then that means that the information, the blueprint, has to be stored somewhere in the cell to access the information needed to rebuild the cell. Where is that information stored? DNA. So DNA is essential, or some information storing system is essential to life. So what happens is the sequences of amino acids in the proteins and all the other information in the cell is encoded into DNA. Much any computer programmers? What do you all study? What do you guys do? Are you like all artists or musicians? Or do I have to change my analogies? Okay, that's fine. So what happens is Bill Gates made a very good analogy. He said, human DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any we've ever created. Because this computer program not only has all the information for the parts, it also has all the information, the operating system that runs everything efficiently, so you produce the right stuff at the right time in the right place. Now, why is that significant? Here's why it's significant. Let me use an analogy. Who's ever eaten like alphabet soup? Now, if you have like your Campbell's alphabet soup and you're a kid, you want to stir that up. And what do you want to see? Words. Maybe your name. Maybe God speaks to you because your name appears, right? Or perhaps your girlfriend. Who knows? But what happens is that may work if your name is Ed or Bob, but what if your name is Jehoshaphat? Are you ever going to see that in, or more, let's use another analogy. Let's say you go to the restroom and you come back and you see this. You will have success in business. Now, when you saw that, would you think, wow, what an amazing coincidence? Just by chance, would you ever assume that? It's too complex, there's too many letters, it's too specific. And would you ever think, well, maybe if I learn more about organic chemistry, maybe if I understand the chemistry of the pasta, then I can explain the message. Or perhaps the physics of the boiling water, then it'll make, will that ever work? No, because those letters are free to take any order they want, or that the designer wants. And because they're free to take any order, they can contain information. And the exact same thing is true of DNA. There's no chemical reason why one letter in DNA is next to another. It's, again, it's like Morse code. It's like you take a sentence and you encode it in dots and dashes. The difference is DNA has four letters and not just ones and zeros. It's A, C, T, and G. Or RNA is a bit different. So what you see in biology is you see information in DNA which points to a mind as clearly as that message in your alphabet soup. Because if you have a book, you can explain the physics of the paper, the chemistry of the ink, but a book is more than ink and paper. It's the information, the ordering of letters that produces sentences. The same thing with life. Now, what's interesting is that's pretty compelling in terms of the origin of life, but what happens after you have a cell? Is it possible that once a cell is formed, it could reproduce and evolve and so forth? And that's kind of the idea of Darwin. So if you look at the idea of Darwin, the idea is you have a cell that formed long ago, and then that cell became more complex. It formed branches of animals and plants and fungi and basically the overarching tree of life. So the idea is that over time, very first small changes accumulate over millions of years and create big changes. And that's the idea. And what's important is Darwin created a huge shift in culture, because before people would look at life, and they'd assume that the appearance of design in life was real. You look at the eye, it looks like that of a camera. You look at the wing, it's thermodynamically designed. The feathers are intricately designed for what it does. You've got incredible machinery in the brain to process information. And people said, that sure looks design, right? But then with Darwin, that all changed, because he argued the appearance of design is an illusion. So he said, if you have sheep, for instance, and that you crossbreed sheep over time, you can get a woolly sheep, you can get whatever sheep you want. And the idea is that a crossbreeder could do that, but perhaps nature could do the same thing. Like if you have really cold winters over time, what happens to your less woolly sheep? They freeze and they become dinner. And then over time, the ones that survive have a lot of wool, so what happens to the sheep year to year? They get woollier and woollier, right? So Darwin said what used to require design, crossbreeding, nature could do by itself. So maybe if that happened over millions of years, all the intricacy of design that we see is simply an illusion. It's simply by the natural processes. There has been some serious problems, though. What Darwin realized is there was something called the Cambrian explosion. But before I get that, I just want to show you two quotes. Let's go to this quote. This is by Francisco Ayala. He says, it was Darwin's greatest accomplishment to show that the directed organization of living beings can be explained as a result of a natural process, natural selection, without any need to resort to a creator or other external agent. And that's important, because you have people that will argue, let's say, for some sort of theistic evolutionary idea that perhaps God could have used evolution, but Darwin's idea is very specific. No design anywhere. It's all chance. That's key. Let's go to the next quote. Richard Dawkins said, biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So that's the whole point. And the key word is what? Appearance. That's the picture. But what Darwin realized was there was a huge problem to his theory. It was called these missing fossils. Because if you go back in the ancient Earth, you see the first appearance of many of the major animal types we know today, like an arthropod, like a trilobite, like a vertebrate, like something like a brachiopod. It's like a clam type thing. They seem to appear at once in the fossil record, and there's no transitions leading back to the source. He said, that's a huge problem with my theory, but as time advances, we'll discover those fossils. We know we will. It has to be the case. Well, guess what happened? Next slide. They found what was called the Cambrian explosion. Next slide. Here's a picture. What you have is the y-axis is time, and the x-axis represents the first appearance of major body plans, the first time you see something like a vertebrate. And again, they appear suddenly. Next slide. And you see all these radically strange things appear without clear ancestors. It looks more like, honestly, it looks a lot like Genesis. God said day one, day two, day three. And then what you also see is there isn't the millions of transitions going back to the trunk of an evolutionary tree. So the fossil record, the pattern is that things appear suddenly, very different from what happened before, and then they don't change. It's called stasis. And that's why Stephen Jay Gould came up with punctuated equilibrium. Now, you may have heard of transitional fossils, right? The problem with these transitional fossils is they're not what you think they mean. When you hear the word transitional fossil, you think what they mean is you've got an ancestor, a descendant, and a descendant. So you have a linear progression, seen evolution in action. Who thought that's what transitional fossil meant? Right? That's not what it meant. A transitional fossil simply means it's a fossil which shares characteristics of two different groups. Like a toaster oven has characteristics of a toaster in an oven, right? But if you change a toaster into an oven in a gradual process and stop halfway, do you have a toaster oven? You have a mess. So you have lots and lots of toaster ovens in the fossil record. You have no true transitions. You have no sequences showing anything new coming into being suddenly. And the problem is, there's lots and lots and lots of similarities in nature, like the eyes of humans look like the eyes of octopi, right? But those similarities don't fit into a coherent tree. In order for evolutionists to fit the data into a tree, they have to throw out sometimes more than half the data. Now, when you do science, what happens if you throw out all the data that doesn't fit? Guess what happens to the data that remains? It all fits. So we'll talk about that more tomorrow night, if you're curious. However, the situation has gotten even worse. Again, I mentioned I was at the Royal Society meeting of London, and the conference was New Thinking in Evolutionary Theory. And here's one of the main speaker. He was one of the organizers, a very respected evolutionary biologist who's completely secular, has no religious inclinations for what I recognize. In his opening talk, he talks about what's called the standard evolutionary theory. That's what you read in your textbooks. He said, evolution explains small-scale adaptations. If you have, let's say, a finch, how do the finch's beaks change over time? But he said, the secular evolutionist said, neo-Darwinism can't explain large-scale change. It can explain the adaptation of a finch. It can't explain where the finch came from in the first place. He says, neo-Darwinism does not explain things like the complex behaviors, complex body plans, anything really beyond small-scale changes. And he said, and this is really amazing, I couldn't believe it. When I heard this, I was just like floored. He says, it's not even designed to do so. I mean, you've all heard neo-Darwinism can explain large-scale changes, right? It wasn't just me. I just wanted to make sure about that. He doesn't simply say it's wrong. He says it's not even designed to. But it makes sense, right? Because if you have a car, you might do some little changes to your car. You might move the seat up. You might move the seat back. But can you never change your car into a helicopter through small changes? What happens when you put a propeller on your car and you start to rewire the energy to the helicopter? The car runs a lot worse before it can fly, right? It's the same thing in biology. Natural selection works beautifully for small-scale change. It does not work at all for large-scale change. So the question, though, is if what I'm saying is true, and it is, why is it that evolutionists resist the evidence of design so strongly? Why are they absolutely determined to explain everything through natural law? Is it their objectivity? Is it their desire for truth? Well, maybe not. Let's go to this quote. This is by a famous professor named Richard Levantin. He's a Harvard professor of biology. He says, it is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, so we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Let me translate that to you in more simple language, because it's kind of early to work at words like material. So anyway, He's saying, we assume as a matter of faith that there is no designer. And even if we see evidence that would suggest otherwise, we'll accept any explanation, no matter how bizarre, how implausible, how wild it may be, in order to suppress the notion that there's design around us, because we will not allow it as a divine foot in the door. Well, this should remind you of another verse in the Bible, and this is from Romans. Paul says, he talks about how the wrath of God has been revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So it's this picture of how people suppress the truth. Now that can happen at two levels. You can have a person who's just, you know, a womanizer and cheats on their taxes, who doesn't want to believe in God, so they suppress the truth. I don't see design. Or it can happen as a culture. So our culture has essentially developed a scientific methodology and a secular mythology that says there is no design. It's a cultural level suppression. So as you go to school and you watch, you know, the Bernstein Bears talk about evolution, you watch your TV programs, what happens is something happens to our minds, because God designed our minds to see design. Even a child that looks in the world, if they're raised by atheists, will still see design, and you have to beat it out of that child. So our education essentially suppresses that part of our brain that can see design. It's a sort of culture-wide psychosis that we experience, so that we no longer are able to see the design, and we no longer have critical thinking, so that we know to reject ridiculous theories. That's where we are. And the challenge, though, is as the science advances, the positive evidence for design gets stronger and stronger. I just want to give you a little image here. This is a little video to give you an idea. This is called a bacterial flagellum. It's like the outboard motor of a boat with a propeller. So let's play this.
Bacterial flagella are composed of about 30 different proteins. First, a protein called FlyF forms a rotor ring in the cell membrane. FlyF self-assembles to form the ring, which then becomes the foundation for other proteins to attach, which in turn becomes the foundation for the attachment of others. The self-assembly takes place in methodical order through the accurate recognition of appropriate others. With a motor in place as the foundation, the filament that acts as the propeller is then formed of proteins called flagellin. With the help of a capping protein at the tip, flagellin molecules, sent out from the cell body through the central channel of the motor, stack up to form a helical tubular structure. The structure revealed by electron microscope. All of these experiments have shown that flagellar protein export occurs in the following manner. First, and this ternary protein complex binds to the C-ring and waits for the export gate to become disengaged. When the export gate is free and available, the ternary protein inserts the amino terminus of the flagellar protein into the gate. Later, fly H and fly I detach from the export gate through ATP hydrolysis. The export gate utilizes proton motive force to send flagellar proteins into the channel. It unfolds flagellar proteins into long stretched chains for export into the tune. The whole chain is within the channel. It is transported to the distal end of the flagellum.
So again, you kind of have to ask yourself, that's a molecular machine in a bacteria. You kind of have to ask yourself, does that look like something that just kind of came about accidentally through random collections of atoms? Or does that look designed? And the answer to that is obvious. And that's the encouraging thing, is the more science advances, the more it affirms the idea that we're fearfully and wonderfully made. And why does that matter? That matters because the science shows us that there is a God outside of time and space who's all-powerful, who created our universe out of nothing. It's a God who shaped our planet according to his will to allow us to live and to do science. And it's a God who's so intimately involved in the world, so imminent, he programmed our DNA. So what that means is we can live with faith and hope and confidence. But it also raises an interesting question, right? Why is the world such a mess? Anyone wonder that? There's a God all-powerful and caring. Why is the world such a mess? And the only explanation for that is the Christian story. Because we as Christians believe God created us to be in a relationship with a loving God. But we said, we don't need that. We'll live our own way. And that's kind of like this. Have you ever had a plant and you cut the roots off the plant? What happens to the plant? It dies. It doesn't receive the nutrients. In the same way, we were created to be in relationship with a God that gave us unconditional love, that gave us an eternal purpose, that gave us a sense of security and power over the world. Without that, the source of life is broken, so we replace it with idols, with temporal things. And that's kind of like if you've got a car that runs on gasoline, what happens if you put kerosene into the tank? It breaks down. So if you look at why is there evil and suffering and pain and anxiety and environmental destruction, it's because of the brokenness of the human heart. But Jesus came into the world to transform our hearts, reconnect us with God, we forgive our sins, and then use us to go into the world and to bring transformation and bring it to a creation order God intended. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us at Every Nation New York City, where our vision is to partner with God and people to transform the city one life at a time.